I need to go into a phone booth and jerk off.
Still, queer as folk. Tonight, Emmett promises God that he'll never have sex again. And Michael turns 30 in a very messy way. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Surprise!
It first aired on Showtime in the U.S. on February 25th, 2001.
It was directed by Michael DiCarlo, who would go on to direct 11 Queer as Folk episodes. It was written by Jason Schaefer and Jonathan Tollins. This duo also wrote episode 9, Daddy Dearest, Sonny Boy. And individually, Jonathan Tollins wrote episode 6, The Art of Desperation. Jason Schaefer wrote episode 5, now approaching the line.
You notice that that's episode 6 and episode 5 equals episode 11?
I did not notice that.
Mind blown. I usually don't do this, but I'm going to read both synopses from Showtime and IMDb for a very specific reason. See if you catch on. From Showtime, Brian throws a gala surprise 30th birthday party for Michael, who is newly single. But Brian makes a scene when he outs Michael to his smitten coworker. Poor Tracy. Ted and Emmett decide to get HIV tests together, but Emmett receives a troubling response from the doctor's office as Michael visits David to beg for a second chance.
Okay, the only thing I picked up there were tons of spoilers.
It's literally the episode.
We've seen this before where we get a synopsis and we're kind of done.
Right. I mean, like, why are we going to go on for another
hour? Let's go to Babylon. Make that hydrate.
Oh, God. I don't go to hydrate anymore. From IMDb, Michael ends the relationship with Dr. David. Ted and Emmett get tested for AIDS.
Whoa. What? Read that line again.
Ted and Emmett get tested for AIDS.
Okay. What else goes on?
Brian throws Michael a surprise 30th birthday party and outs Michael to his coworker. Emmett makes a pact with God.
So this was the IMDb synopsis?
That was the IMDb.
That, I think, needs to be updated.
That is incredibly problematic, and I literally think I'm going to write to IMDb and say, you need to change this because that's not what happens. You get tested for HIV.
Not AIDS. Not at that point, anyway.
No.
So those are two very different things. So for me, already this episode isn't holding up. It's off to a rocky start based on something entirely unrelated to the episode. Damn you, IMDb.
Oh, how dare they?
So this episode didn't exactly have a theme other than to kind of take the Queer as Folk Etch-a-Sketch and shake it all up. To set things up for the rest of the season, something major happens to every character here. The storylines are all different, but nobody is left unscathed. Justin moves in with Debbie. Emmett's HIV scare results in him swearing off sex. Ted has a moment of reckoning about the mostly untold story of his infatuation with Michael. Tracy finds out that Michael is gay and storms off. Debbie mostly does the same thing after thanking Brian. Melanie and Lindsay are on the rocks. Michael, air quotes, breaks up with Brian and moves in with Dr. David Cameron. And Brian is left friendless. Where's the theme?
That's just a whole heap of a lot.
Yeah.
When you break it down like that, there's a lot that goes on in episode 11.
It almost seemed as if this was the first episode of the second half of the first season. So it seems as if they were trying to build up all the characters to start marching towards the finale. The writers put everybody into a different situation that we hadn't seen them in before, but it didn't really seem to have a specific purpose in mind other than to carry the story forward, marching towards something that's going to happen.
It felt almost, it was very soap opera-ish, and it felt like it was definitely supposed to be a two-parter, you know, between what goes on in episode 12, which we'll get to. But yeah, it felt very like the storyline is going to continue, so we have to throw in a lot so we can wrap it all up in the next episode.
Yeah, we see that a lot with Queer as Folk in season one, where a lot of things that go on in one episode are really just teeing it up for the next episode. The The interesting thing about this one is that we've got some writers that have written for the show before, and they go on to write even more for the show. So I'd like to think that they've got a better idea of what the story arcs are going to be and who these characters really need to become.
Well, let's talk about what's going on when the episode opens.
This opening was nice. It had a David Bowie song in it. And unfortunately, if you were streaming it, once again, you get terrible music.
Screw Netflix at this point. Seriously.
Well, don't be too harsh. We'd welcome them as a sponsor of the show.
So, I'm so sorry, Netflix.
So everybody's strolling down Liberty Avenue. David Bowie's Boys Keep Swinging is playing in the background. And the talk is all about Michael about to turn 30.
And then once again, it's that whole 30 equals death business.
It
and
really does, though, Matt.
No, it doesn't, Patrick.
Does. You will find out in just a few months.
Less than a year, yes, I know. But it boggles my mind that they feel like somehow everything ends at 30. And I'm sorry, but I feel like daddy is a phase that a lot of people are looking forward to now. So
what?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Everybody daddies aspires to be a daddy.
A renaissance.
What are you talking about?
This is why I don't think life ends at 30.
Well, you certainly don't become, you don't become a daddy at 30.
Tell that to some of the younger folks who have talked to me.
They invoke the daddy word.
I have been called daddy. I was once called daddy when I was 25, and I was like,
what?
Calm down.
I think that would be an immediate limp dick moment. It's like, I don't know why you just said that, but get the fuck out. You have to go. You can't stay.
Nathan can stay.
But yeah, so everyone...
I did like the guy walking down the street who was markedly old.
Oh, right. To say, Michael, that's you.
That was like Jason coming up out of the lake or something. He's like,
well, and I just love that he was also in like leather gear.
Yeah.
On this like dreary day. So odd. Just like, if you're going to have the epitome of old queer leather daddy,
yeah,
just walking down Liberty Avenue, middle of the day.
At first, I thought that he might have been just like in a kind of a vision. But as the scene progressed, he actually walked by the gang as they were walking down Liberty Avenue. So it is real. He just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I think at this point, we're starting to see that Michael and David had broken up.
As they, of course, turn in to go into the diner, Michael mentions that having sex with the same person got boring, which, of course, everyone then threw back in his face because we all recall his conversations of coming multiple times and 27 minutes on the nipples.
I still have a problem with that one. But
again, disagree.
Lack of imagination. Come on.
Taking his time.
Stop throwing your pen at me.
He was taking his time, Patrick.
We also see here that Justin is the new Liberty Diner busboy.
I loved that reveal so much.
Did you notice that it didn't appear to be Justin's real hand that flipped off the gang?
And it, well, and there was like a whoosh.
Hey, busboy.
Yeah,
the sound effect when he flipped them the bird, and I was like, that's a little cartoonish.
Well, the hand was entirely misshapen. It was all kind of blobby, and there was like no wrist to speak of. It was whatever you call a cankle of the wrist. So I don't know if that was real or not.
Well, that whole moment was very cartoonish, but I enjoyed it because, you know, it shows that Justin now has to accept responsibility for his actions in the previous
episode.
For
his felony behavior.
For his felony. He committed a crime, so yeah. He should be happy that all he has to do is pay back Brian, and he's not going to jail.
I did see that Ted is a latent Justin hater. When they were making the introduction to Justin there, you see Ted like completely roll his eyes anytime Justin was mentioned. I'm not liking this little angle here.
Oh, no. I don't think he hates it. He just, again, after that coma, Ted is just sassy mouth. Because remember, he even makes that comment about Justin's buns being fresh, which I thought was hilarious. I was like, witty, Ted. You are on it. You are on fire. It's great.
I mean, it's one thing to see Michael predictably disparaging Justin, but I don't know. It feels like Ted is always just piling on.
It's a little old, and I want Michael to get the hell over it.
Yeah. Debbie came over to the table and was asking where David is.
Where's David?
I think he had a patient.
Don't bullshit me.
It ran its course, Deb. Leave it alone.
So I started to wonder how long ago Michael and Dr. David actually broke up. Was this supposed to be last night, or was a little bit of time supposed to have passed? Because Debbie didn't seem to know about it.
Well, I mean, I think if it was like literally less than 24 hours, she wouldn't have asked. But if it's obviously it's been a minute. And I like that she was able to see right through it.
Yeah.
Like Michael coming up with some excuse, and she's like, at this point, I'm surprised she didn't shake and go like, what did you do?
Yeah. She did want him to fix it, though. So. Mm-hmm.
Charming, handsome doctor who wants nothing more than to be your partner in life. Yeah. So we have to then go to the pharmacy because Emmett's stomach was a little...
Is that why they went there?
Yes, because remember, he ordered blueberry pancakes.
Oh, and that's right.
And literally within... And he's all so excited about it. And then within 30 seconds, he's like looking for antacids.
Ted, that little bugger... We find out that not only did he have sex with the pharma hunk, he bought him bareback in a Land Rover in the parking lot.
He must be positive. Yeah. That's why he has such a good body. They put him on steroids, you know?
What? You're safe, aren't you?
He has one slight brush encounter with this super hunky man. Next thing you know, he's getting pounded without a condom in
the
parking lot.
That was a funny scene with it was the music. Really, and
that it was a Jeep.
Are you sure that wasn't a Land Rover?
It was some sort of large SUV, which seems to be very popular with the gays of Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah, so it must have been a Jeep.
And so it's just so funny to see. Not only was the car on.
The lights were on, too.
But yeah, like, I was like, I guess.
Lights, well, stereo, maybe, everything.
I mean, maybe it was just cold. Like, maybe they had the heat on. But, I mean, they were fogging up that car pretty good. Like, and that thing was rocking.
Emmett seemed to like the story.
I need to go into a phone booth and jerk off.
I like how Emmett just kind of drops in this little moment where he just says, what, you were safe, weren't you? And Ted is literally melting in the pharmacy.
And they sneak this in where he mentions that he had sex with this guy about 6 months ago.
Oh, yeah, good timing.
And I was like, way to sneak in the timeline about when to get tested. Good on you, writers. Yeah. I almost walked right past it. And then I realized, oh no, they set up the timeline so that he can have this legitimate fear that since he had unprotected sex with this stranger who was, as they were running into him at the pharmacy, that he was receiving some sort of cocktail or treatment.
Yeah, they also had to get Ted out of the way with that storyline so that Emmett could take front and center with the HIV storyline.
Right. I mean, it's...
So Ted literally had to get his test results and be okay. If it had just happened last week, there would be a waiting period before he would test again, and they just had to get him out of the way of the scene and make it all about Emmett. Let's step by the big Q for a minute, because it's Michael's birthday.
what's her name? The real sassy man.
Marley.
Yeah, she says there's a fire.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Michael runs into the back room going, where is the fire? Turns out there's a surprise party.
Mr. Manager.
Mr. Manager.
I'm sad that Bob Barbarossa was not at this birthday party.
Well, he's now, you know, the district or regional manager, so he has many more responsibilities, and now it's up to Michael.
I did like that they had these fairy cakes for Michael, and fairy cake is the British word for cupcake. So,
how apropos for Michael to have a fairy cake.
Did you just take away one of my UK chips there?
You know what? Now that you mention it, yes.
I just saw you write that one down. Michael has like frosting all over his face because he just ate the aforementioned fairy cake. And Tracy comes up and just kisses him right on the lips with the frosting.
That was very forward. I was a little taken aback by that.
I don't know if you noticed this, but it seemed almost as if they had dumbed down Tracy a little bit. She didn't seem to have any makeup on. She looked very two-dimensional and flat. And I don't know if that was just an oversight or whether that was part of the storyline, but she did not look glamorous in any way.
I guess I didn't pay enough attention to that moment. I was just so taken aback that she decided to full-on kiss Michael in front of a coworker and everything. I'm like, oh.
With frosting.
I'm like, whoa. And then I'm watching this thinking like, Michael, this is all on you. This is all your fault. Yeah. You let this go on way too long.
You seduced him. You fucked him. Previous episode.
Always nice to call back to a previous episode.
So suddenly, Brian and Michael are in the steam room. So I guess work's over, right?
Right. And Brian is rightly deriding Michael for his actions of keeping himself in the closet. Now, let's get to the more important part of this steam room scene. So they're having these conversations and more men are filtering in into the steam room.
I know where you're going with this.
Sans the towels. And what...
Social gym.
Right. Now, what then took me completely off guard, and then I got super excited about... Calm down, Patrick. I know what you're going to say. is that we finally see full-on penis in this show. The show about gay men with all these erotic sex scenes. We finally see dick.
I'm going to have to go jerk off in the phone booth with Emmett.
It took 11 episodes and it wasn't just like teasing us with like some pubic hair or showing us the V. No, full on penis.
Surely you've seen one before.
Once or twice in my life.
On occasion. I'll talk about the dialogue that was going on in the scene.
There was dialogue. I was not even remotely aware.
Maybe you should have kept a good doctor around. You'll always be younger than him and cuter.
I thought you couldn't stand him.
When did I ever say that?
Every chance you got?
Maybe he wasn't such a bad guy after all.
Well, now's a hell of a time to tell me.
Why, you didn't break up with him on account of me, did you?
Of course not.
That's good. Because we can't spend the rest of our fucking lives hanging out together.
Where did that come from? Why is Brian all of a sudden making a comment like that to Michael when... I don't know. I just didn't see any motivation behind that comment.
That's what was eating away at me in this episode.
The steam room?
Brian is making such strong and extreme decisions in this episode that it took a very long time for me to like put the pieces together. For instance, in this steam room, him admitting that Dr. David Cameron's not so bad after he had made all these efforts to try and keep him at a distance from Michael.
Yeah, I still disagree on some of that, but I know where you're going.
To then also say, also, we can't be attached at the hip as much as we are anymore. And I'm like, you have a sort of symbiotic relationship. You can't exist without each other.
Right.
That for this to then come up was so odd to me.
I guess it was just teeing up the next part of this episode that we'll get to in a little bit. It seemed as if it came out of nowhere, but it didn't seem like a throwaway line. So we'll have to talk a little bit more about that as we get into the episode. Mm-hmm. So let's jump to the doctor's office where Ted and Emmett appear together. Emmett, the safe sex poster boy, is dancing with the skeleton.
I love that comment because... Emmett like has shown himself to not necessarily have a whole lot of in-person sexual interactions, especially when we had the episode where he was so deep into the internet sex.
Yeah.
Or the chat room porn.
Use my hole 27.
Right.
The interesting thing about this scene is that suddenly Emmett and Ted are best friends.
I'm serious. If anything ever happened to you, you're too important to me.
That just seemed a little... All of the sudden, we didn't really know to this moment that they were like BFFs, or did we?
Well, I mean, we see them as a group more often.
Right.
So that when we have these moments that we can break away from them and it's just two of them together, I think we see that those relationships have been there. Because remember, we're jumping into this show with already established relationships. So we're having to, we have to work on the assumption or the given circumstance that these people have been together for a long time and they see each other all the time. I mean, they are literally hanging out with each other all the time.
It seems like now that you mention it, the story really could have been them meeting for the first time in episode one. And a lot of these storylines might have worked a lot better. So this was an interesting scene. We'll ignore the fact that they're in the office together because that seems like a boyfriend thing to do.
We have Ted getting tested because he had unprotected sex. And then Emmett getting tested, too, because he knows that that's his routine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to mention that apparently the only physicians that exist in Pittsburgh are incredibly attractive because Steve, I believe is his name.
Steve.
Dr. Steve. I don't know if he was actually a doctor, but he had a stethoscope and a white coat. So I'm going to go with the assumption that he's a doctor.
Please take my blood.
Take it. Take it all.
I just spilled all over myself.
Did Dr. Steve make you flood your basement, Patrick?
Now. Let's check in with Justin at Debbie's house.
You would think that Justin is now Debbie's son.
Sunshine. Here, take these on up to your room.
Get up. My room.
Come on, sweetie. Back off, huh? You're about to be 30 years old.
He's staying in Michael's room, which, of course, is grating at Michael. He's, you know, doing chores and helping Debbie out around the house. And I'm like, you know, she saw a kid in need. And this is, again, why I love Debbie. She's like the den mother of this whole group. And I love that.
I would like to think that she had taken in other wayward gays in the past. We never see any evidence of it, but I think that would have really been interesting to...
I mean, she takes in Vic. I
know that's her, true.
I know that's her brother. I know that's her brother, but I feel she definitely goes above and beyond for him.
Vic had some good lines here. He was in his comedic best, interjecting here and there, talking to everybody that's in the room. Michael started to say some things that I thought were a little strange about dating Dr. David Cameron. And how it mean that he can't see his friends, he can't go out, that his life would totally change. But
which is all bullshit, because he was doing all those things anyway.
Yeah.
And I never felt like Dr. David Cameron ever made him feel guilty about it. Hell, Dr. David Cameron would go out with him every once in a while.
He'd slip in his club kids clothes.
Yeah. Hit some poppers and dance on the dance floor in Babylon. And I'm like, Michael, you are like, he's totally sabotaging the whole thing. And
either that or it's just bad writing. One of the two.
Well, that leans into it a little bit by showing that there was a very immature level to Michael. I mean, it's one thing to be into like the toys and the collector's items and the comics because plenty of it. I mean, that's because they're a legitimate art form. But the way he treats the relationship with Dr. David Cameron just spoke to like where he was at an emotional immaturity that he could not handle that because he has this warped sense of what a relationship means.
I mean, David really cared for you. You could see it in his eyes. Vic, couldn't you?
I don't know. I was too busy looking at his chest.
There'll be someone else.
There'll always be someone else. But there won't be someone like David every day.
Well, then he dials Dr. David Cameron on the phone. There's those split screen shots that we really like. And Dr. David, Michael doesn't say anything. Dr. David says, Michael, I have caller ID. It's
like, I loved that.
Caller ID. That really dated the show as well.
We have caller ID on our cell phones.
Yeah, caller ID is, I don't even think you use that term anymore. It's just a thing, right? It's like, it's not something you buy separately from the phone company.
No, well, that's true. Now it's just part of it.
Yeah. So, but Dr. David, he's rich. He can afford caller ID.
Oh, yes, he can. And what? How did you describe his home? Because I loved that. I thought that was really fun.
Oh, the architecturally perfect mid-century modern home.
It's still gorgeous.
Yeah, I come to find out I had one word out of order there, but we'll get to that at the end of this episode. So, meanwhile, at Brian's loft, Debbie shows up.
I love that Debbie was in this loft.
Debbie's everywhere.
Oh, she comes up and she is like...
No caller ID.
They wasted no time. She's just lambasting Brian. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm just sitting here drinking my wine, watching her go at it and enjoying every second of it.
She shows up and Brian acts like Debbie shows up all the time. It's not unusual for his best friend's mother to come over to his sex den. And she's laying into him and she says...
He had a chance with David, but you had to fuck it up.
He wasn't having any fun.
He's had enough fun. You've all had enough fun. It's time for him to be a man.
And what do you want me to do about that?
Well, I don't know. Something. You owe my kid something.
Well, we talked about this when they came back from the country. I still contend that Brian was mostly innocent in that.
What she is describing, though, is beyond just the weekend in the country moment. She's pulling it back from the second Michael met Brian that he's been a bad influence.
Yeah.
And so she's using all of this evidence against Brian and this latest thing with Dr. David Cameron and his interference of that relationship, which as much as you want to say that he didn't, he did. He had many intentions of always overstepping his boundaries and trying to keep Michael on his side. That's why she's telling him, like, it's no longer going to be a mutual decision. Brian has to be the one to say enough. If he keeps going, Michael's going to never be happy.
But Michael has to take some sort of responsibility for himself in this, because however he's acting and feeling isn't because of Brian, it's because of himself.
But Brian's manipulation, which I think speaks to his narcissistic character traits, that's something that Michael can't control, because Brian
he can control Brian, how he responds to it, though.
Brian will charm him. He will seduce him. He will do whatever he takes to keep Michael on his side.
But he just keeps falling for it every time. But get a backbone, Michael.
Well, that too, but...
If you don't like the way somebody's treating you, speak up and say something about it and have consequences to it. He just lets it all happen. And then his mother comes over and yells at people over it.
But... I could almost say that I feel like the relationship between Brian and Michael, at least at this juncture of the show, is very emotionally abusive. And it's hard for someone who's on the receiving end of that to break out of it.
This comes up again at the end of this episode, so we've got a lot more bitching about this to do.
I think we will continue to fundamentally disagree on this.
Brian decides to wrap this scene up. Brian decides to throw a party, and we see a quick little mischievous look on his face. So in this one isolated case, I will be on your side, and that Brian is going to be devious about it. Let's go to the sex store with Melanie and Ted.
Which, I love this pairing. Like,
it's the two young professionals.
Mel and Ted have found some sort of common ground in which they can be alone together and carry on a conversation, or in this instance, go sex toy shopping. As like a, which I understand it. They're looking for like a gag gift for Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Going through the many, many, many dildos, vibrators, accoutrement.
I like that device that Melanie picked up.
It was like what are they called?
Pitchfork.
It was something.
It had two ends on it, needless to say.
Right, and I feel like that was more for a woman's pleasure than it would be for a man's
not for
pleasure.
Justin.
No.
I liked the dialogue that was happening here. We find out that Melanie and Lindsay are suffering from LBD. Lesbian bed death.
Can you go into further detail about that, Patrick? Because I'm not familiar with lesbian bed death.
It's this myth that after lesbians have been together for a period of time, they stop having sex and they become almost like BFF or old married couple. And so it started to be called lesbian bed death.
Okay.
I didn't make this up. I read about this when I was reading lesbian fiction.
Oh, God. Yeah, so this is where we get that clear indication that there is trouble in paradise. But what I love about this thing is that there's a lot of wordplay between Ted and Mel.
Yeah.
Like, they're the repartee is just witty, and they're snipping back and forth. And it was kind of fun to watch, even though they're talking about something that's very distressing for Mel.
It's not just the sex. I feel like she's shutting me out. I don't know how much longer I can take it.
Look, I don't want to hear this.
Why can't I share?
Because the minute you start telling your friends your relationship problems, it's the beginning of the end. Find a shrink.
I've been in therapy for 6 years.
Are you covered by insurance?
Yep.
Great. Then have a breakdown. You can afford it.
Jesus, what is with you? You are so negative.
From your lips to God's ears.
There was one thing that dated this episode in that the cell phone rings and they didn't know whose it was. And it's like, oh, is that me? That's me.
Oh, I thought that kind of advanced the show. I mean, granted, their actual phones are very dated.
Yeah, that was back when there was really maybe three phones to choose from and they all sounded the same. They all rang the same way and everything. So that immediately dated it. That was pre-ringtones.
It's for Ted, and he finds out that it's the doctor, and he finds out that he is negative. He is so negative. And Mel jumps on that. She's like, hey, what did she say?
Well, that's okay. Happy people can be really annoying.
I loved that. Like, that was such a great setup.
One interesting thing about this is I think back then the HIV testing protocol is forbidden to give results over the phone that way. I remember my first HIV test. They actually made me go back to the office to get the negative result. Here, they just blurted out to Ted over the phone.
And so Emmett and Ted are now in the park, and it's the weekend. And Ted sort of buried the lead about him.
I think it was Friday night, right? It's Friday night just after the office had closed.
Oh, okay.
And Ted mentions it to Emmett. Emmett says, oh, I'll check my messages. You know, back then, you would usually have your cell phone turned off to save the battery, you know, your 20-minute battery. He turns it on to check his messages, and it's the doctor who wants Emmett to come in as soon as possible. Emmett has to wait until Monday because the office had closed.
And what this reminded me of, and I'm about to go on a massive tangent, but it's worth it. It reminded me very much of the episode of The Golden Girls called 72 Hours. And in this episode, Rose receives a letter that during a transfusion, when she had had her gallbladder taken out, she possibly received blood that had HIV antibodies.
Oh my God, that was on The Golden Girls?
On The Golden Girls. And the way they dealt with this episode was so incredible and so progressive, because she goes in, gets her test done, and she has to wait 72 hours for the results. And so then it's, as what goes on in this episode with Emmett, is that there's an entire weekend of not knowing. Mm-hmm. Not knowing how your life might change, if it's going to change, what are you going to do, how are you going to make it through. And what's so smart about the Golden Girls episode is that she's then able to confide in Blanche, who is, you know, known as the promiscuous character in the show. And they confide in each other that Blanche also had a scare. She made her, it made her rethink some of the choices that she's made. And she talks about how important it is that she have understanding of the history of the people that she's with. And it really spoke to very smart sexual health. And this was primetime sitcom that was on, you know, in the late 80s, especially when it was in the height of the HIV AIDS crisis. It's kind of amazing that then 20 something years later, we have a show like Queer as Folk that is dealing with the exact same thing. And I feel like even today we're dealing with the same thing.
Blanche, when you were tested, how did you make it through?
Just kept it to myself and acted like a real bitch to everybody else.
So Dr. David's out for a run in the rain, and he jogs back to his architecturally perfect mid-century modern home. And look who's in the driveway. Oh, it's Brian. Wearing more ghastly outfits. He had on a dark-colored suit and an open-collared peach shirt.
For a man who is as successful as he is, I really question Brian's style.
He has his moments.
Does he, though?
Remember
our first episode, an underwear check?
Yeah.
That
we've established that the customers don't pay a whole lot of attention to underwear.
Oof.
So Brian invites Dr. David to the surprise birthday party. And there was a nice tension builder here where Dr. David doesn't accept. He doesn't decline. He just walks into the house. There's a little bit of a cliffhanger there. We don't know if he's going to show up or not. I think I secretly knew that he would show up. It's like he couldn't miss that. He couldn't miss Michael's moment.
As we discover about his gift when he comes to the party.
Yeah. Emmett and Ted finally get out of the park, and they're back at Emmett and Michael's house, and Ted's there. Emmett is very shaken up. He doesn't have his test results yet. He doesn't know what he's going to do. He has to wait until Monday to get his results, and Ted is trying to comfort him. This scene had an astonishing piece of cinematography in it. Emmett and Ted are sitting on the sofa. Emmett's clearly distraught, and the camera is circling them. So we see that there's a together moment. And as Emmett gets up and steps away from the sofa, the camera pulls away from him, and we see Ted in the background. And it puts Emmett into this alone state. And then Ted steps back into the shot, closer to Emmett. And then Emmett's not alone all of a sudden. Emmett delivered the line,
God, how the fuck am I going to get through this weekend?
And it was a very, very moving scene. It fell apart in a few minutes, but up until that point, it was great to see camera motion. It was great to see Emmett and Ted from every angle. It was very much exposing them as vulnerable and alone as the camera isolates in on Emmett and then pulls away with Emmett and then brings Ted back into the shot. I really, really, really like the camera work and the direction on that scene.
And it's such a quiet moment and truthful moment and intimate moment. And I really enjoyed that.
It was great. Loved it. Then suddenly Michael comes home and Emmett's like, boom, back into like Nelly Retail Queen mode. And he's all excited and happy and he's all about Michael. This is where I thought the scene fell apart a little bit.
Oh, I would disagree. I don't think it's about Emmett has presented himself throughout the series as the happy-go-lucky, most, for lack of a better term, positive person in the series. So to not worry his friend on Michael's day, he puts on the happy face.
Maybe Peter Page just acted too well there. He didn't bring enough of
what a problem. You were too good in this scene.
Well, because there's this the astonishing cinematography scene that I just talked about, which is kind of cheapened a little as soon as Emmett comes back to life. That needed like a fade to black moment and a pickup into a different scene. But instead, Michael comes home and Emmett just doesn't have a care in the world all of a sudden. And they cajole Michael into going to the party.
No, I think that, as I stated, it shows that Emmett he'll put on the happy face for Michael. And we do see how that plays out when we get to the party.
Yeah, that's true. Everybody shows up at Brian's party. And suddenly...
And remember, it was supposed to be a surprise party.
Yeah.
and Michael was being such a little dick. And Emmett and Ted, I wrote this in all caps. Ted says it all. And he tells him to just like shut his goddamn mouth and let us go to your surprise birthday party.
I thought it was just a cheap laugh, though. I thought that. No, that whole setup and getting to Brian's house where it was just...
Ted said what I'd been wanting to say for 11 episodes. Suck it up and be 30 and it's fine.
You would think that Michael would know that there's going to be a surprise party, though.
Well, I mean, he's gotten so much in the episode about, like, not wanting to celebrate it. He wants to, like, just get in his bed and, like, sleep the day away and not even think about it.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
I did like how Brian's loft was essentially like a recreation of the Babylon set. Right. You know, there's a DJ there and the bar is all laid out. There's people walking around with hors d'oeuvres.
And Justin is the one behind the bar.
did you see that funny line that he and Melanie had with each other?
They were like BFFs in this scene, but I cracked it up when she asked them, how do you know how to mix drinks?
Margarita, no salt.
Right up.
Hey, how do you know how to mix drinks?
I'm from the Gentile country club side.
A small little bit of Jewish humor there, because we know that Melanie is Jewish and Justin is very waspish in his background. And so it was really cute. And I love the way that they were playing off each other throughout this entire scene.
And then then at some point they're just like slamming shots. Another reminder.
I think Melanie can be disbarred for that, for drinking with a minor that
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Remember, Justin is still 17 years old. Yeah.
Then Dr. David comes lurking out of the shadows. It's like, oh, yeah, he did show up, but he's like hiding or something.
No, he's coming through like the decoration or whatever. I don't think he was hiding.
Yeah, his entrance was a little meh. So Sugar Daddy Dr. David comes in and they're opening gifts. And oh, look, Sugar Daddy Dr. David buys Michael what seems to be a very expensive watch, possibly a Rolex. Yeah. And everybody's like, ooh. Until Brian.
Well, and what was so hard, what was so heartbreaking about that moment with the watch is that he said that he got it engraved before, and to just ignore that and look at the different features that the watch has. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, that made my heart hurt a little.
It's good to three atmospheres. And so Brian's gift is Captain Astro in the flesh, who appears. And he gives Michael a Captain Astro number one comic book. Okay.
Right. But this is like the Holy Grail or something to Michael.
Yeah, there's a small UK chip I've got to play here. Is that number two?
This is two.
Obviously, this scene was copied from the UK version of the show. Cameron gives Vince a car instead of a watch that we saw in the US.
Whoa.
And Stuart gives Vince a functioning K-9 robot dog from Doctor Who. K-9 was Doctor Who's little sidekick throughout most of the series. So there's been many versions of K-9, but that was the gift there. So I felt like that worked a little bit better, car versus K-9. Instead, we have watch versus comic book. So,
I feel like a car is a little excessive, though.
It was a mini. So, like it's a legit a mini.
It's still a car.
Debbie realizes that Brian's gift upstaged David's gift. And then Ted takes a dig at Brian about the gift, too.
Oh,
but
so great.
Brian, I'm going to defend Brian here. Brian had no way of knowing that Dr. David was going to give him a Sugar Boy gift. He had no way of knowing that. So everybody's digging at Brian, but Brian did something nice for Michael.
He did something so extravagant that there was no way that Dr. David Cameron was going to win. That's their point. He went like right to it.
But he bought an appropriate gift for Michael versus...
It's the way he presented the gift, though, by getting a in-the-flesh Captain Astro, who looked like he was wearing some sort of rubber suit,
yeah.
to present that gift and then to say, go dance with the birthday boy Captain Astro. I mean... He upped the way to deliver the gift in such a way that Dr. David Cameron didn't stand a chance, as many people said.
But Brian gave a very appropriate gift for his best friend. Dr. David gave an inappropriate gift for his BF, Sugar Boy, whatever we want to call him. I think Brian just knows Michael well enough.
At the time.
Michael didn't want to watch.
No, at the time, Michael was still his boyfriend.
You're wound up here. You're pointing at me with a pen right now.
Yes, to get my point across. At the time.
I have to step back here.
Obviously, it was going to be a gift that Dr. David Cameron was going to give Michael at probably some private moment based on that there was some emotional attachment with the engraving that he told him to ignore. Sure. Brian could have given him the comic book.
Did you just give me the hand? You just gave me the hand while you were saying that.
He could have given him the comic book. And yeah, absolutely. Appropriate gift. It's the way he decided to give the gift and make sure that his was the last one given so he could upstage everybody. But in this moment, especially Dr. David Cameron.
Do you think he was going to like withdraw that gift if Dr. David gave a better gift?
He wasn't going to do a damn thing.
Meanwhile, Melanie and Justin have added cigarettes to their debauchery behind the bar.
They're having their own party.
That was some great directing there. And there wasn't much to it. They were just in the background. They were doing their thing. That cut was probably 2 seconds, but it was so cute. I loved it.
But watching this whole sequence, especially when Mel and Lindsay and Debbie are having a conversation, really made me question about whether or not Mel may be an alcoholic.
I think at various points in the show, everybody loses their shit on alcohol. It just gets wasted. Alcohol or more. Ted went into the coma. But I think at one point or another, everybody has their like regrettable drunken moment.
Ooh, welcome speaking to me at 24.
Speaking of drunken moment, Uncle Vic is at the party and he is drunk and he's just kind of floating around wearing a floral print shirt and
living his full Charles Nelson Reilly fantasy.
Emmett latches onto drunk Uncle Vic. So let's just play the scene and listen to it for a minute.
I thought I was being safe. Careful.
Sex isn't careful. If it is, you're doing it wrong. It's messy. And it's human. And it's mixed up with other things. It's a genie who won't stay in the bottle. Listen, Emmett. If you think you made a mistake, move on. And accept it like a man.
That was some fantastic writing there. I don't know where that came from. That little speech that Vic gave was just so spot on for the moment. It was just a small section of the party scene, but it was enough to really get Emmett to accept it like a man. And in a few minutes, we're going to see exactly what he thought of that line. But first, we have to also make note that Gus is at the party, too. Like less than 1 year old infant to the party
to Babylon 2.0 apparently. And Lindsay, you know, found her spot in the corner, and she's of course breastfeeding Gus at the party.
First of all, he's at the party. Second of all, Gus is being breastfed at the party, and get hate mail, public breastfeeding, like it, don't like it, whatever. I don't think you do that at a party at Brian's house. Do you?
I'm not bothered. I have no opinion on the breastfeeding, really. It's more the way Lindsay is trying to deal with her infant son at a party that is not really appropriate to have him at. They really should have called the sitter.
It's got to be like midnight by then.
Right. Well, the other issue, too, is the way Mel is acting, because she is trash at this point.
Loved it.
But it was to the point where, I mean, as a significant other, I would be embarrassed and be like, Mel, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Oh, well.
And Lindsay had every right to be angry at her or to, you know, be tiffed at her. And as much as Debbie, she's like, you can't say anything inappropriate to me. You know, but she, I think also Debbie could sense that there is trouble in paradise with those two.
Emmett dances his way to the bathroom. And he passes the Captain Astro orgy.
Okay. I want to see what you think of this. Was that moment heightened, or was there, in fact, an orgy going down? Because when Emmett makes his way past the orgy, we then see in the background, it's like, yeah, there's some couple of people making out, but it didn't seem nearly as intense as it was when he first walked in.
I don't know. I took it as orgy. I know an orgy when I see it.
It felt like it was heightened in a way.
A heightened orgy.
I felt like the sound effects, the sound mixing in that moment, just like really drew out moans and moments like that. That it felt like it was exaggerated to
I can see
put
that.
Some fear in Emmett.
Fear and sort of the hotness mixed with the danger of it.
Yeah. But Emmett goes into the bathroom.
Did you see that bathroom set design?
That was looked like the Like a Virgin video. What the hell was going on with all these candles?
I did like it, but it was just a little too obviously church.
Yeah. Like it was obviously, I get the religious moment, but then I also wanted to know, like, did Emmett start praying to God in a moment of desperation? Because we've never known Emmett to be religious in any way.
I think
so. Where did this whole like I'm gonna pray to God thing come from?
I think the state that he was in, where he had good reason to believe that he was about to have a life-changing event, drew him towards the only higher power that was available to him at the time.
Maybe it's a moment, I could take it as like a moment of desperation, maybe. Like, who else do you turn to?
Yeah. Well.
And then, of course, when Mel's like, is anyone in there? Excuse me, I'm going to vomit on your altar. Which was.
She did just bust right into there and just move him right out of the way.
She's been slamming like whiskey or something.
Margaritas. And smoking with Justin and doing shots and.
Ugh.
She's awesome. I want to hang out with her.
Oh, I would totally hang out with Mel. I think she and I would get along really well.
Ted and Michael have a funny scene going on here. Ted is basically explaining to Michael not to let the pitch go by. And he's drawing on his own personal infatuation with Michael to do it. Why did Ted think he even had to say something about this? Because his coma was a while ago. There was a little bit that they talked about at the moment. Why did he feel like he needed to bring that back up again?
I think it comes down to we're at this party for Michael. He's watched the interaction between Dr. David Cameron being there and Brian's gift. And he knows that there's a bit of a perfect storm of conflicting feelings and emotions happening. So I can understand why he found this in a moment to chime in with something that he's been holding. Because Lord knows he's not aware that Emmett and Michael have seen his shrine. Oh, Michael, Navani. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Brian started it when Ted made a dig at Brian, and Brian just pulled this out of thin air about the Michael shrine that Ted had set up. But Brian was holding on to that one for a while. He had that one in the chamber and ready to go, and it completely immobilized Ted and set him on this course of having that awkward conversation with Michael.
But it was a conversation that needed to be had. I will give credit to Brian in this moment because he says, "I'll let him go if you let him go." And that's fair because you know, yeah.
Did you think Ted didn't let him go?
Well, based on how Ted reacted when Brian told him that they saw his little shrine, which, by the way, you know, harken back to what, 7-8 episodes ago?
when Ted's not dead is the episode.
That the shrine finally got dealt with. It never felt like it got dealt with until now.
What was this about? Was Ted trying to tell Michael to get back together with Dr. David, or was he telling him, like, restating how much he was in love with him? Or this whole arc never had more than a few minutes of screen time, but in this episode, it took up a pretty good amount with principal characters.
I think we may have to continue to think on that one.
Well said.
Well, then comes we hear the buzzer.
Oh, Vic answered the door, I remember.
Come on up. And get your cock out.
I remember Vic is trashed. And it's Tracy. When the camera cut to the front door and it was Tracy, I nearly fell out of my seat. This legitimately, like, I couldn't handle it. Because then Vic is like, come on up. And have your cock out. And I'm like, you're a mess, Vic. But also, oh my freaking God, Tracy's about to come up here. And I was like screaming at the TV.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Then Brian, she gets up there and she's like, wow, this is like a really awesome party. And Michael says, I don't even know any of these people. I only know six of them.
Which is true because Brian said he only invited his sexual partners.
And then, Brian drops the boom, and now it's Michael to Tracy. Dr. David.
And not in a subtle way at all. He said, oh, by the way, Dr. David Cameron is not just Michael's chiropractor. That's his boyfriend. The first time they fucked, he came how many times?
Oh, God.
It was brutal. And I was shaken by it. And Then Dr. David Cameron just, bam!
Drops him. It's like every fight in the show so far is like one hit and they're on the ground.
I mean, Dr. David Cameron obviously works out, so.
He does.
I think he has one hell of a left hook.
And a previous episode, he did say that he's good with his hands. Whew. So Tracy runs out entirely embarrassed and whatever else she's feeling.
She's been humiliated. Like, I don't know about that. Really, Patrick?
She's overreacting.
Wow.
I mean, okay, so.
She was.
How many dates have they gone on?
Okay.
Two.
It's not about the number of dates they've been on, Patrick. It's the fact that Brian invited this woman and made a mockery of what she thought were legitimate feelings with this person. And he did this in such a public setting.
I don't know. There's only like four people listening. The music was still playing. The orgy was still going on. Emmett was still praying. Melanie was still throwing up.
I have no more words. I'm legitimately...
Yeah, you walked into that one.
Tracy, who has been completely thrown under the bus by Brian.
Well, in my own defense, in my notes, and you've got my notes in front of you, I wrote, I feel sorry for Tracy, but she had all the warning signs of
when
Michael.
When you're in love with someone, sometimes you ignore warning signs, okay?
She can't be in love with him. They shared a cupcake.
Some frosting.
Bob and Betty Barbarossa's party.
Okay, and Michael could have stopped so much of that, but he didn't.
Yeah.
Because in that moment, she probably felt used because now Michael has this promotion, but he did it without any feeling towards her. I'm glad that she has this moment outside the apartment to say, you must think I'm stupid. You must think that, do you laugh at me? Do your friends laugh at me? She has every right to just go after Michael in this moment.
Okay. I can see that. Back inside, Brian's healing his jaw with some trail mix. And
he is a trash human being in this moment.
All the principal characters leave, and one by one, they take a dig at Brian on the way out.
But yeah, seriously.
It was like a receiving line.
Exactly. I like it's like that moment in Airplane when they're all waiting to beat up that woman. They're like all in line with their barbs.
I thought it was a funny show of unity amongst all of them that they all left at once. I think it's pretty rare that an entire squad leaves the party altogether. They're like so like outraged that they all leave. Usually there's like a couple people that stay. There's always like one guy that's like found the meth or something that's just not going to be like dragged out of the party.
I think that was Captain Astro. and so everyone gets at him except for Justin, who I think recognizes that Brian just had it incredibly rough and is like, while you were shitty, you're going to need help cleaning up this party. So
I think he said cleaning up this mess, which I think is significant.
Oh, yeah.
Justin all of a sudden comes out of his drunken stupor and is the voice of reason once again. So meanwhile, at Dr. David's architecturally perfect mid-century modern house, Michael tells Dr. David that he wants to give things a try. With him.
But I love what Dr. David Cameron says. He says, I'm not a consolation prize.
Yeah. Michael had the line, I'm 30. It's time I settled down and took on some responsibility. What? You work at the big Q. What responsibility are you taking on here?
I think it's not like the business responsibility. It's the personal responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, it's him recognizing that he needs to grow up a little bit and be more, you know, I keep saying this about him, that he's emotionally immature. I think this was his moment of finally cracking that he needs to grow up emotionally.
Yeah. And kind of step away from Brian and the club kid type of thing.
Exactly.
So it's the next morning and back at Brian's loft, he comes strolling out of the bathroom with his bottle of Jim Beam.
I'm glad you pointed out the Jim Beam, because really, Brian, of all the whiskey you're going to drink, Jim Beam?
Are we supposed to think that he was up all night just nursing that bottle or out of guilt? Or I didn't get it. But Justin wakes up in bed fully clothed.
Right. And he said he wasn't sick, so he figured out that margaritas were his drink.
Yeah. Debbie, of course, shows up and finally realizes that Brian did this all on purpose.
And I'm glad she said it, because I sat there thinking, Brian was such a prick about the way he handled everything, and he took everything to such an extreme that I was about to be like, screw this episode, I'm done. It was just so outlandish.
Yeah.
That I'm like, Brian, you could have been a little more subtle in the way you wanted to handle this, but you had to go all the way.
Yeah.
Well, which I think is even pointed out to him.
We wouldn't have drama without Brian going all the way and over the top and everything. I like that Debbie used the term, this David, when talking about Dr. David Cameron. And it was the same way that Jennifer used this Brian. And it seemed almost like it was on purpose there.
Those mothers stick together. It's great.
Yeah. So that said, Emmett and Ted are at the doctor's office. And we find out that Emmett's check bounced, and that's why they wanted him to come in right away. The doctor puts the move on Emmett, and Emmett turns him down to Ted's obvious surprise.
If it was a bounce check, that's something they could have mentioned on the phone.
Definitely. Emmett says that, I prayed and told God that if I were negative, that I would never have sex with another man. It's like, Emmett,
the level of... Really, bitch? That I had when he said that was incredible.
And the episode wraps up with a reprisal of David Bowie's Boys Keep Swinging and a pull-away shot of Brian reading the Captain Astro comic that he had bought Michael. It had a nice, powerful ending of Brian all alone with big poster-sized pictures of Michael behind him. And we know that we haven't seen the end of it. And that's, I think, why the ending worked pretty well. So... let's recap here. The question that we ask is, does this episode hold up 17 years later? For me, sure. The HIV bits are mostly accurate in that they captured a lot of the anxiety over HIV testing rituals. The story of Brian having to hurt Michael to push him away is a little far-fetched, but it's reasonable enough in a drama series. I'm a soft yes on this one.
I think I'm going to be a firm yes on this episode.
Hard yes.
And it comes down to the way that they handled the HIV storyline. I feel like the sexual health practices still hold up. I feel that it's still important, even with the advances that we've had in gay sexual health with PrEP, that regular testing is still incredibly relevant, that there still needs to be this type of sexual education, especially when I actually had a friend tell me that she was having conversations with people in my generation about how HIV is transmitted, and they still feel or had heard that it could be transmitted through a kiss. And I was dumbfounded by it. And even when she explained to them that that's an incredibly, incredibly rare thing to occur, they still had some reticence in believing her. And that terrified me in a way, because...
Well, it's no secret that gay men are probably some of the best educated people in terms of HIV and AIDS. So it doesn't totally surprise me that straight people have a very unique point of view on it.
I think the last thing I'll say about it, especially considering, so I'm very involved in the theater world, and we had a composer this year, Michael Friedman. He was only 42. He passed away from complications of HIV/AIDS, which apparently no one in the industry really knew that he was HIV positive. There are plenty of performers and people who are in the public eye who are HIV positive and not ashamed and very much acknowledge that is part of them. And it was because he had not been tested in years. By the time he got tested again, that he found out he was positive and that it was at such an advanced stage, he only lived a few months after being tested. seeing this episode with that information in my head really made Emmett's situation that more poignant and really showed to me that even 17 years later, we still have to be vigilant about how we handle our sexual health.
This episode brought up an awful lot of topics that the series hadn't dealt with before. It had its comedic moments, it had its dramatic moments, and it had the very, very somber moments. So this episode got two yeses from us. This was episode 11, Surprise. Next week, we'll be talking about episode 12 of season 1, Move It or Lose It.
I'm Matt Dominguez.
And I'm Patrick Randall. Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.